graduate work?
I did.
And what kind of preparation there did you have for monetary policy? Did you have Elvis Wicker as a professor?
I did, as a matter of fact. I had Elvis Wicker, and I took some money in banking, and I had some just finance courses, and I actually went up a somewhat different route. I got an MBA and then decided to move into economics and got an MA and a PhD in economics, and so I had it both from the economics department side as well as from the business school side.
Did you have some good teachers? Did you feel like when you got to the Philadelphia Fed, you had some pretty clear ideas about kind of the big issues of the day, what causes inflation, what caused the depression?
Yeah, although I had a, I think the most useful classes that I had at Indiana were sort of a applied macroeconomics classes, business conditions analysis and that sort of thing, and I actually was brought into the Fed. In those days, there was a kind of separation between monetary policy and macroeconomics, believe it or not. At least that was the case at the Philadelphia Fed. There were financial economists and monetary economists, and then there were people who watched the DNP and
yeah, same
labor and that kind of stuff, and you know, as time went on, that was an artificial split, but that's the way it was done, and I actually was brought into the Fed as a kind of a business conditions guy, and that's what people wanted to hear a lot about, both at the boardroom, board table, as well as in the district, and I gave an awful lot of talks and speeches, really my first year there, and I got to do some board presentations, and so I came at it from a slightly different angle, I think, that people probably would do it today, and may have even been different than the way you approached it or Al Broaddus approached it.
When did you begin to work with Eastburn on FOMC preparation?
Actually, right away.
That's extraordinary to jump in. Most people, it takes them 10 years before they figure out.
I came in and had a break, I guess, because the senior guy in the kind of macro analysis, business conditions, that sort of thing, decided to go somewhere else. And there were only like 8 or 9 economists at that point, and so I guess what Eastburn decided to do was to see what I was made of, and so they delayed going out and recruiting a senior fellow, and I guess it worked out for me, because then I became the senior guy in that area, and made you know. So I was really making pre-FOMC presentations, I would guess, within 2 or 3 months after getting to the Fed. And then I was actually the director of research within, I guess, I don't remember exactly, but say 3 years or so, 3.5 years after I got to the Philadelphia Fed, because the guy who was the head became the first vice president, which was unusual, and that was Mark Willis, who then went on to be head of the Minneapolis Fed, and so things moved fairly quickly in those early years.
Is Mark Willis still around?
Yeah, he went to the Minneapolis Fed. Somewhere in, I would guess, the big companies out there, and then he moved on to become the head of the whatever the company is that runs the Los Angeles Times.
Right, Times Mirror, I guess.
And they had a shakeup out there, and so he retired, I think, quite well off financially, and I understand he did a little professoring, and not exactly sure what he's doing, but mm-hmm. he's still a relatively young guy, so I wouldn't be surprised if he, if he resurfaces doing something.
So what year did you join the Philadelphia Fed?
Joined in 1968.
Mm-hmm. And when? What was your first FOMC meeting? What date?
I think it was in the fall of 1971.
Mm-hmm. So it was after wage and price controls were imposed. They were imposed August 15th, 71.
Yeah, and I think I probably went in at the October meeting, and then I went pretty regularly from then on.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you some questions about Burns and any insights you have into him. On the one hand, here's this guy with an enormous amount of prestige. He was Mr. Business Cycle, head of the MBER, and you know, sort of in, along with Mitchell, invented the modern art of business forecasting, leading indicators, and so on. But on the other hand, there was a lot of his attitudes like the sort of like the average businessman. Labor unions caused inflation. He one of the very early proponents of wage and price controls. How did Eastburn and you in Philadelphia see Burns and you and kind of how did you try to get through to him and talk to him at FOMC meetings, get your point of view across?
Well, I think that Burns was an old-fashioned business cycle guy who was a more a product of the Depression, and I think before he came to the Fed, I don't think he had much appreciation for monetary policy. I think that he grew up in a period when inflation was not an issue. It was mm-hmm. stimulating the economy, and I think came from a background in which he looked at the non-monetary disturbances to explain the business cycle. And so I think he came not really with much of a sense of monetary policy, and I think he came without much of a sense of inflation being a threat. I mean, there were some people who were fairly cynical, believing that he was sent over by Nixon White House basically to keep interest rates low, he did try to do that, essentially. I don't think he was mostly on the side of keeping interest rates low, and so I just don't think he, whatever his motivation, I think he really sense the connection between monetary policy and inflation. I think early on, I think, as I recall Dave Eastburn's comments, I think Dave had more of a sense of the role of monetary policy, and I think saw maybe not as clearly as one sees in hindsight, but I think he appreciated the threat that monetary policy held as far as a threat for inflation. I recall somewhere along in there, I don't remember the exact years, but he dissented, as I recall, three times running. Now, that doesn't often
No.
And I think he let Dave know that privately, but I think Dave felt that there were 12 votes around the table and 19 people around the table, and if only wanted one view, then the FOMC would have been one person. So I think he spoke up. He was not a table pounder. And then as the inflation of the 70s went on, I think became really more concerned, and we got into issues about monetary aggregates versus interest rates, and we got into Fed targeting monetary aggregates. All through that Humphrey Hawkins business, and I think Dave spoke up, and I think he was well prepared for it. We would normally have a briefing of several people at the bank, and then he and I would, we almost always took the train, and we would talk on the train, and then usually we would talk after dinner on Monday nights and talk and go over issues. And in those days, it was people normally had prepared statements, and we would take a draft and go over the draft of the statement. And I don't think he usually read it word for word, but I think the basis for his remarks.
You were able to see Burns over most of his tenure as FOMC chairman. Do you feel like he changed his views over that period, or he was always had the same basic kind of views about inflation and the role of the Fed?
I think his views might have been tempered to some degree, but I think he basically held on to his views as time went on. I think inflation is probably aided by monetary policy, but my sense was he still had a largely non-monetary policy view of inflation, and that monetary policy played a junior role, which I must say was not at all uncommon for people of his generation and his educational background.
Well, you mentioned you talked to the directors. I assume that our 1971-72, they were for controls on wages. At least Richmond's directors were.
I think they viewed it more as a cost push, a wage push, and then later as an oil kind of induced inflation, and there were some deficits in those years, and I think they viewed, at least some of them, viewed higher interest rates as being a brutal way of trying to tame inflation. So I think while they were not for wage and price controls, I think at least some of them viewed it as a lesser of evil.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Did, as you listened to the debates between the Keynesians and the monetarists, between Friedman on one side and Tobin and Samuelson and Solow on the other side, did your own views change over this period?
I think so. I mean, I pointed out earlier that I had obviously monetary policy and finance courses in graduate school and undergraduate, that I'd come at it more from what was in those days called a macro or a Keynesian kind of view, and I think my views changed as time went on, and I think increasingly I'm came to the view that monetary policy was the primary cause of inflation, although I think that these other factors are important in the sense that if you don't have any cost push problems or energy problems, that monetary policy can influence inflation in a less costly way. But I mean, I think ultimately, though, inflation is a monetary phenomenon. I think I certainly came to that view, but I also never bought into the idea that, as was popular in the academic world, that you could just simply control the aggregates without regard to the environment that you're in and everything would be okay, because I think it is tougher for the Fed to control inflation when you have all of those non-monetary things working against you. One certainly can, but the short-term costs are higher.
Yeah. You mentioned 1972 and the issue of Burns and politics. The Fed had money targets at that time. Well, they were ranges.
I think that came a little later, though.
They had 2 month ranges for M1 growth at this time, and they were derived from a quarterly benchmark. I don't want to call them targets. They were really benchmarks, and I don't know if we want to talk about this, but Philadelphia debated this very heavily internally in 77, 78, whether they should be treated as targets or benchmarks, and, you know.
Yeah, I think there was a term for it, and I can't remember.
Tolerance.
They were not considered targets in those early years.
Tolerance ranges. Ranges of tolerance for the...
Something like that, yeah, ranges of tolerance.
There were these 2 months... There were these.
But steadily, largely in those earlier years in the 70s, I mean, it was still essentially a Fed funds. Right. I mean, we met every 4 weeks, and
right.
And the, as I recall, it was a quarter of a point, which in those days was considered major progress because of.
Yeah.
Before I started going to the FOMC meetings, the FOMC met every 3 weeks, and I think they had 8 little points.
Yeah. So before the elections, these, whatever we want to call them, these 2 month growth ranges for the monetary aggregates, money was clearly coming in above, and Burns was unwilling to raise the funds rate. There was quite a bit of discussion at that time. There was even, when inflation rose in 74, there was a Fortune article. Do you feel like Burns was sensitive to the political situation?
My impression was that the question was clearly yes, that he was quite sensitive to it. I think intellectually he rationalized that sensitivity because of the way he viewed the world, but I think I think he was sensitive to it.
Mm-hmm. How did he get his way in FOMC meetings?
Chairman control the agenda. They influence the staff. They preside at the meetings, he was a very strong-willed chairman. He didn't tolerate dissent very well. He used techniques that I didn't think were really right. For example, I remember one president whom he was particularly fond of made a statement, and Burns basically ridiculed him. I know that he occasionally, when he would talk to people in private, so I think he was, in a sense, a bully.
Our bank was, I guess unhappy is not a strong word, but you know, unhappy with the way that he treated Al Hayes, whom I, at least our president always thought of as a gentleman.
On Al Hayes, and Al Hayes was such a gentleman.
No.
The Burns let him have it, and they even did things like control his travel and that sort of thing. So there was no doubt that part of that, I think, was he two things I think were at work. One is that his own memory and experience went to the earlier days of the Fed when New York Fed was the dominant force.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Secondly, I think that there was something of a, I don't quite know what the word is, but I think he viewed Al Hayes as kind of an elitist sort of fellow, and that, I think there was a little bit of class work there, class distinction at work. That's hard to ever prove that, but Burns was part of an immigrant family.
Yeah.
Was a painter, a house painter earlier in his career, and Al Hayes had all the Ivy League credentials, New York social status, and I think there was some of that at work, in addition to the residual tension that exists.
Well, that's I think that's
work in the board.
I think that's insightful. Burns always had to dominate the situation, and that may have come from having grown up in a very humble background. His father was a house painter, and Burns was somebody who said always had to dominate the room he was in.
Although I remember once I went to a party somewhere here in Philadelphia, and this fellow came up to me, whom I had known. I didn't know him well, but he was a very distinguished professor at the University of Pennsylvania. They had like four, I think, Benjamin Franklin professors, which was really top professorships and reserved for really prestigious guys. And he came to me and he said, started to describe Burns in an FOMC meeting, and I said, have you been to FOMC meetings? And he said, oh, no, he said, I've never been to an FOMC meeting, but he said, I used to be on the National Bureau Board when Burns was the head of that, and I just don't, and I know Burns' personality, and I know the way he ran those meetings, and I just presume he'd be the same bully at the FOMC meeting, which I found interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. He could be gracious also. You don't remember the name of this person. I should know who that is. We can go back and look it up.
He's dead now.
Yeah.
He died several years ago into his 90s. I can't think of it offhand, but he was a Benjamin Franklin professor of business history or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he made those comments to me just based on his knowledge of knowing Burns in the National Bureau days.
Where was Walt Rostow? Was he at Philadelphia?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. I was just trying to think of somebody who was a historian.
Right.
What about the Ford administration? Was monetary policy different in the Ford administration, or that was the
it was a relatively short administration, and I think they frankly didn't know whether they were fighting inflation or fighting recession.
Yeah.
And I think there was some back and forth kinds of things, and I don't really know if the White House then had the same focus as the Nixon White House had on the Fed. I think
was extraordinary.
Had not only the Watergate, but you had the ignominious ending to the Vietnamese War. You had
The pardon of Nixon.
Nixon pardon. You had
and the deepest recession since.
Exactly, and you still had inflation, and you know it was a time when I would guess that the Ford people were just not that focused on the Fed, and maybe didn't even think the Fed had a significant role play at that point. And that's impressionistic, but that was my sense of it.
So you get into the Carter administration, and in 77, the recovery is clearly in place, but Burns is very cautious about raising interest rates, presumably for the reasons you mentioned. He thinks that the inflation that's out there is not the Fed's fault, but he's very cautious about trying to make sure the recovery keeps going. Does that sound right?
I think that was true, and I think Burns really did like being chairman of the Fed, and whether he harbored some sense that he might be reappointed in a Carter administration, I don't know, but I think he wanted to irritate administration, and I think he was, he didn't let go of the Fed all that easily, because after Miller was appointed, he stayed on the board for a few months, and there was a brief period, very brief period, when he was no longer chairman of the board, but he was still chairman of the FOMC.
I'd forgotten that. I guess Miller came on in maybe March, and Burns was there through May of 78.
And I think, but then there was a meeting, as I recall, a telephone meeting, and Miller had been confirmed as chairman of the board, but Burns was still chairman of the FOMC, and Burns then said that it would be appropriate for Miller to be the chairman of the FOMC, and I think he may have nominated him, and that was taken care of. I do not recall, however, I don't think it happened. You'd have to check the records, but I don't think that Burns ever attended an FOMC meeting after that, even though he was still a member of the board for a period thereafter.
That sounds right. Let me ask you about the nature of the FOMC under Miller, and also about the staff, because Miller comes, he was chairman of Textron. He obviously didn't have a background in monetary economics. Something was circulated with our department where he had made a statement suggesting that reserve requirements were placed on bank loans rather than deposits. So somebody was running things. Was it a combination of, when Miller came in, was it a combination of top staff and then strong-willed governors like Governor Partee, who were the primary kind of movers of monetary policy?
First of all, Miller had some, not very much, at least exposure to the Fed as an institution, because he had been on the Boston Fed Board for a few months, and I don't remember him being chairman, but maybe he was chairman, but I know he was on the Boston Fed Board. He brought a whole, he was a lawyer by background, although I don't know if he ever practiced law per se. I think he did practice law early in his career, but his view was really quite different. How the FOMC ought to be run. I think he viewed it as a kind of corporate board meeting.
Yeah.
I think that he wanted shorter meetings. I don't think he was about the importance of the chairman always being in the majority. There was an episode, not at the FOMC meeting, but over a discount rate vote, and I think he did come out on the short side of a discount rate decision.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And it was just unfathomable, I think, to observers of the Fed and the marketplace that this would happen. And I just don't think he appreciated, you know, occasionally chairmen are on the short side of a bank merger case or a regulatory decision. Not often, but it's happened. And I just think that he, I might say it happens without great consequence, and I just don't think he appreciated it. Monetary policy. I remember the shortest FOMC meeting that I ever recall. Vice chairman died.
Gardner.
Steve Gardner died. But he was vice chairman of the board. He had a brain cancer, as I recall. His funeral was at 11 o'clock, and it was on an FOMC day. We had to leave the board, I think, at 10:15 because it was up at one of the chapels at the National Cathedral. And I think he was really quite pleased that he could get this group to finish up in 2 hours and 15 or 20 minutes. And I think he thought that's the way it really, really ought to be. And I think he was a decent human being. I think he was certainly an intelligent man. I don't think that he and the Fed chairmanship were made for each other.
Mm-hmm. My recollection is that...
I say he was a very nice man, too.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a nice man, and I don't think he did. It was different than Burns in the sense that I think he let people say what they wanted to say, and he never tried to be critical of them. The other thing I remember about Miller, which is just a footnote, is that, you know, Burns was a smoker.
Yeah.
That room was like a barbecue pit, and then Miller came around. I don't know if he was an ex-smoker, but...
Well, Volcker and Wallach, too, were
smokers. Oh, my God, they smoked, you know, and he put no smoking signs all over the room. And so the staff, he was the boss, so the staff didn't smoke, but some of the other guys did. And, I remember they just smoked anyway. And I think it just irritated Miller, but he went on. And when Volcker came back and all the cigarettes and the cigars came back, it was just sort of a personal thing. As a matter of fact, some of the seating arrangements at the FOMC have a lot to do with who smoked and who didn't smoke, because Philadelphia was used to have a different seat, and Philadelphia didn't smoke, and Dave Eastman didn't smoke. I was not a smoker, and they tried to get the smokers on one side of the table and the non-smokers on the other side. So you think these things have some rhyme or reason, but some of it all went back to that.
Yeah. I guess Richmond was a little less positive about Miller's personality. I think we felt like he did not like dissent from the regional bank presidents, that he drove a wedge between the presidents and the governors who were more liberal, and that Miller kept at least our bank president from getting sort of standard salary raises because of
that
dissent.
I don't know. I did not sense that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Made a visit to Philadelphia. He came, I remember, for the dedication of our building. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't, and that may very well be true, and I wasn't a Reserve Bank president then. Dave Eastburn might have a sense of it, but I didn't. My impression was that Burns was vindictive, but I didn't have
Gardner about the committee. Phil Coldwell and Steve Gardner and Phil Jackson and David Lilly, Chuck Partee, Henry Wallach. Was this a strong group of people, or?
Dave Lilly, you wouldn't put Dave Lilly in that category. I think certainly Chuck had a lot of influence.
Yeah.
Henry Wallach was both a giant in his own right as well as a gentleman.
Was he influential?
I think he was influential. What are some of those other names you just...
Phil Coldwell,
Phil Coldwell, I think, was an influential governor. I don't know, I didn't have the sense that he was that influential in monetary policy. You may have thought he was, I didn't get the sense that he was. In
mm-hmm.
the meetings, I thought Wallach and Partee were more influential. Steve Gardner, I don't think, played that much of a role.
And then Phil Jackson was
Phil Jackson was he was a outgoing, back-slapping kind of guy who was more used to the business political world. I don't sense that monetary policy area.
Mm-hmm. In 1978, inflation rises sharply, the dollar depreciates sharply, and the Fed becomes very concerned with inflation. But before then, Wallach and Volcker, do you have any sense of them being hawks and being as hawkish as they later became? Or
I think Wallach certainly was. I think if you go back, you'll find a fair number of Wallach sense, and he certainly made statements during the meeting. I remember a lot of solo dissents on the part of
wasn't that later on in the early 80s?
But his background, he saw the German inflation and what it did. I think that Volcker, you have to understand that the New York Fed president always feels handicapped in terms of votes. I mean, I think that Volcker, as well as Jerry Corrigan, for example,
Tony Solomon.
I think that they had all made up their minds that they would never dissent.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they would privately express how uncomfortable they would feel, but I think they felt that they just simply did not want things on the official record that would cause a split between New York and the board, and I think that's a fact of life.
That's an interesting observation. Now that you mention it, I'm sure that's right. That would make much more in the way. Well, actually, in the early 70s, the board was the New York Bank was still very much attached to the Bretton Woods system, and Arthur Burns was not willing to raise interest rates for foreign exchange balance of payments reasons. And also the board of directors at the New York Fed were, you know, very concerned about Bretton Woods.
Right.
And so there were splits, open splits between New York and the board. But I think you're right, after Volcker, it doesn't...
I think after the Hayes era, I think they just decided that it just wasn't worth it, that the New York people, I think, just decided that they would be much more influential if they could work with the chairman rather than being opposed to him in public.
So this sort of jumps ahead, but I'm curious, was that your philosophy somewhat also, that it was better to work with the chairman and try to influence him privately than... clash with him openly at FOMC meetings, threatened dissent? when you became
president? If you're asking me, I don't recall ever. I maybe dissented a couple of times in close to 20 years, so it was not my habit to dissent. But I guess I felt that if distance between my position and the majority or the chairman's position was such that my discomfort level was too high, I would dissent. But I did feel that one had to try to work with the chairman. But I was prepared to dissent at any meeting. I did not feel by no means the constraint that I think the New York Fed president would have felt. I think that, as we got, I think it was harder in the 70s. I think if I had been a president in the 70s, I probably would have dissented. But as we moved more into the Volcker era and the Greenspan era, with a couple of exceptions, I guess I felt that most of the time I could comfortably vote yes. I might have swallowed hard once or twice, but I was always comfortable with myself if I knew that I was prepared to dissent, so I would probably stretch not to.
Did you consider yourself as having a closer relationship with the chairman than most FOMC members, or at least most presidents?
I never considered myself having the closest relationship, but I always felt that they were at least listening to me, and that I could pick up the phone and give them my views. Which I did on occasion, and I found that if I thought monetary policy was getting off track, I had no hesitation to call the chairman and tell him so, and I found him quite receptive.
Mm-hmm. So there were times when you talked to the chairman privately outside of FOMC?
Correct.
When Volcker became chairman in August of 1979, did you already have a sense of what kind of leader he would be, of sort of what a strong personality he was going to be, or were you surprised by the extent to which he kind of led the Fed through a very stormy period?
I think that he was a relatively quiet Federal Reserve Bank, New York Fed president. And so I know some people knew that he had been that way, but I think that Volcker basically was a troubleshooter kind of guy, and I think that he came in a time when things needed fixing. I mean, it was in terrible shape. And I have always viewed Volcker as a kind of a turnaround chairman. I think things were clearly headed in the wrong direction, and I think he knew it. And I think he knew it would be tough to get things turned around. And I think he was the right guy for that, because I think he had the right kind of personality, and I think generally had the right kind of instincts. And I think he knew that in order to get things turned around, that he would have to take a lot of heat from the public and the administration and Congress, and I think he knew what he had to do. He had to regain credibility. I think he had to get inflation headed back downward, and I think he was prepared to accept the economic price, and I think he was prepared to accept the personal price.
The October 6, 1979 change in operating procedures, how did he bring along the for liberal Keynesian governors like Partee and Rice and Schultz and Teeters? Is that obvious that they
were... Well, as you know, that meeting was an executive session, and I was not at that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you call them liberal governors. I think certainly Nancy was in that. But it was just disaster. I mean, the United States had no credibility in the world. The United States, there was no credibility really of the Fed in financial markets. And I think he convinced them that that the time had come for tough action, and I think some of them saw, but maybe gained an appreciation that going to what amounted to an aggregates approach would give them some cover for letting interest rates go up. And I think it's a lot easier, at least I think it was in those years, to say we're targeting the aggregates or some variation thereof, and we're not targeting interest rates. And I think it made economic sense, monetary sense, but I think it also was politically masterful.
Mm-hmm. In 81 and 82, there were sharp rises in interest rates. The funds rate, my recollection, has got up to 21%. And if you had told me in 1978 that was going to happen, I would have been totally incredulous. How did Volcker get away with it? Reagan just couldn't bring himself to...
Well, I think that Reagan, the chairman of the council at that point was the guy from bank in Chicago, who was a disciple of Friedman.
Yeah, first it was Murray Weidenbaum, and then it was Beryl Sprinkle.
Yeah, Beryl Sprinkle, that's who I was. And I think that the administration was dominated at that point by people who had this view, that it was the job of monetary policy to eliminate inflation, and it was the job of fiscal policy to stimulate the economy. And I think that they realized that there had to be a lot tighter monetary policy, and I think that they also realized that things had to be in better shape before 84, and I think they were willing to take their medicine early on, and I think it was... So I don't think in those early years that there was a... only as I think we approached 84, I think, was the administration that sensitive to to rising interest rates. I mean, I think it sort of fit their strategic plan, broadly speaking. I don't think they ever had it that it would go to 20%,
mm-hmm.
but I think that they had the sense that we had to have a very tight monetary policy. I think Volcker's strains with the Reagan people came later, not earlier, and they're also, then we're into the brain span here, but I think it came later.
Do you think it came when Jim Baker became Secretary of the Treasury and Don Regan went over to the
White House? I think it was more Don Regan.
So Regan was just against high interest rates. He thought they were excessive.
I think it was more of a Reagan type thing.
There were new appointments to the governors in the early 80s, Wayne Angel, Preston Martin, Manny Johnson, Martha Seeger. We called them the Gang of Four. I think other people did too. Initially, they pushed very hard for a more expansionary monetary policy. And I hadn't thought about this, but I guess that was the sensitiveness of the White House to the Rust Belt problems, the high value of the dollar, the collapse.
The dollar issue, you know, came front and center in 85 when we had the Deposit Court, and that was a Baker-initiated effort to bring down the value of the dollar.
Yeah.
To help manufacturing, and I think that there was a sense over in the Treasury, probably the White House too, that there needed to be some countervailing forces against Volcker at the Fed, and I think that.
Not Preston Martin, probably, and not Martha Seeger, but Manny Johnson and Lynn Angel came around and became Fed converts, but there was...
Yeah, I think that Manny and Manley, I think people, his name was Manny, but his
Yeah. Name
was Manley.
Right.
Yeah, I think Manley and Wayne ended up being Fed governors. I think Martha and Preston Press, Martin, really never did. I think that Martha really never saw an interest rate that she didn't want lower, and I think I'm not sure that Press had strong views one way or another on it, but I think his instincts were lower rates.
So, Volcker probably resigned because he wanted to run the show and he didn't want to run it with all this sniping going on from the administration.
I think when he resigned, it was over a discount rate decision. And I've forgotten the specific details of it, but it's out. I mean, I don't think it's I think there have been Wall Street Journal articles and others, but it seems to me it took place in like 86.
I think that
possibly 87. And
I think that came earlier, and I think they got over that.
I think it was 86, man. It wasn't any earlier than 86.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I think about it, I think it was 86. And Volcker felt very strongly about probably not lowering the discount rate, and I think the Fuller wanted to lower it, and I think that Volcker knew that he could not or would not be on the losing side, and so I think they had a meeting in the morning, and clearly the votes were stacked against him,
mm-hmm.
so he postponed the meeting, and Wayne actually brokered a compromise, and as I recall the compromise, they did not lower the rate at that point, but did in the not too distant future. I think Volcker stayed and didn't resign.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was not reappointed in 87.
Were the members of the FOMC aware of the LDC debt crisis when it was breaking in the summer of 82, or was it only kind of over time that the regional bank presidents learned about it? And,
I think if the other president, at least I was aware of it, but I think those kinds of debt crises were... There still was the sense of holding that fairly close between the board and New York, and I think they viewed that as their territory, but I think that it spilled over into the FOMC's domain talked about earlier. Really, I think a lot of that motivation, bulk of that motivation, I think, came from that debt crisis and the sense that the system was going to break at those high levels of interest rates. And therefore, rates had to come down, and that's why we had the one recession, and then we had rates coming down, and then inflation still was, the debt crisis receded some, and inflation was still there, and then rates were taken back up, and we had that double dip recession.
Well, and then in addition to the LDC crisis, there was Continental and
'84,
and then Penn Square, and
that's right.
I guess manufacturers and over
all the bank,
Bank of America,
bank things, and there was, it was just a bad environment. We had some in our district. At one point, we had the biggest discount window loan that had ever been made in our district in the late '70s. I think it's still over into the '80s, but I mean, it was a tough time because nobody, portfolio managers just never expected long rates to get that high, and the system was under a lot of stress.
Yeah. So Greenspan replaces Volcker in summer of '87. That was also a time of a lot of stress. Bond rates had been rising that spring. Do you have any recollection that Volcker did not respond as vigorously as he might have earlier on because of the desire to coordinate monetary policy with other central banks and the deal that they would stimulate their economies? Do you feel like he went out with monetary policy too easy?
My sense was that there may have been some of that in that period. I think if we had too easy a period, probably followed the stock market crash of '87. There might have been some of it in the closing period of the Volcker era. I'm not sure he had the votes for a policy much tighter than he had. But I think just as happened following the problems in 1998, I think once you had that, at that time it was a huge drop in the stock market. We had the banking crisis was still going on, a thrift crisis, and I think probably what happened is there was too much ease following the fall of '87. That's my recollection of it. And we were getting back into the problems of inflation, and then we had to have some monetary tightening and got us into another recession. But I think it was. I think.
He brought the inflation rate down from double digits to 4%, and I think the stresses of the financial system meant you couldn't do anymore.
Exactly. I don't think he wanted the thing to break on his watch, and then...
And then inflation starts going up in '89. The Fed adopts the soft landing strategy, and
right.
My recollection is that there was never any specific strategy. The FOMC never said, "Oh, we're gonna bring the inflation rate down." But effectively, Greenspan must have decided, and the committee agreed implicitly that 4% inflation was too high, and it was time to get it down at least to 2%, if not more.
I think that my recollection, now there undoubtedly were people who disagreed. Bob Black, I'm sure, was one. But I think there was a sense that 4% inflation was not worth consciously bringing on a recession to cure it, unlike bringing on a recession when inflation was 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And I think this is where this notion of kind of opportunistic approach to monetary policy, while never was officially adopted, and some people, I'm sure like Bob Black, strenuously disagreed with it. The notion was that if we could hold inflation at 4 during expansion, then, you know, sooner or later the economy would weaken, and we could lap off a percentage or so, and over time, cycle to cycle, we could get inflation down to the 2% or 1 to 2% range. I think that that was in the background, and I think while it was never a pronouncement, I think that there was some I think there was some implicit buy into that notion by a number of people on the FOMC, including me, as a matter of fact. I think.
When did you become when did you become president?
1981.
Mm-hmm. What kind of continuity did you see between the way Greenspan and Volcker made monetary policy? Were the similarities greater than the differences, or the differences were really pretty pronounced? It's just that they both disliked inflation.
I think that there were a lot of doubts about Greenspan when he first came on.
Yeah, especially at Richmond, we thought he was...
Not just within the system, but I think also generally. I mean, here you'd had this tough guy, Volcker, who would turn things around, and nobody could accuse him of being soft or not standing up to a fight. And here was a guy who had these credentials, these very close ties to the Republican Party, and people were remembering the Burns era, and Greenspan was in some ways a legacy of Burns. He had a lot of respect for Burns, and I think there was concern about him, and there was some antagonism there between the administration and the Fed, and that I think there were concerns, and I think that Greenspan came on, I think, trying to show that he had a lot of respect for the institution, for the Fed as an institution, and he didn't come to destroy it or weaken it, and I think he was feeling his way. I think he quickly became quite impressed with the Fed as an institution. I think he became impressed with the FOMC, how it worked. I think professionalism. I think he came to like the independence that he had as a chairman, that he was no longer an advisor or a commentator, that he could make decisions and implement. Then I think he had this early on crisis with the stock market and the financial system, and he knew a lot about the financial system. And so I think I think of Volcker as a turnaround guy, and I think as Greenspan as a guy who simply had to build on the progress that Volcker had made and a lot of the dirty work in the head.
Do you think that the stock market crash in October 1987 had anything to do with the dollar politics between the U.S. and Germany, or between the need for Greenspan to establish credit?
Well, I don't know. You know, I
no way to know.
I don't know. I don't think I recall it with enough clarity, and yeah. I don't think that was just firmly enough in my mind to really give a
following the August 1990 peak in the business cycle, we had a jobless recovery. Do you think that the Fed and Greenspan had something to do with that? Greenspan was concentrating on working inflation down and long-term bond rates down, or do you see the reasons for the jobless recovery as having kind of lying elsewhere than monetary policy?
I think it was a combination. I think that nobody really knew what kind of level of interest rates it would take to get the economy moving again, to get the recovery going. I think that the Fed, in hindsight, I was a part of it, misjudged how low interest rates would have to go to get the economy going. I also think that while most people in the Fed and most of the decision makers took a monetary aggregates approach to things, I think that we hadn't really focused very much on the impediments that developed in the credit granting side of things, and most monetary trained economists just think that'll happen automatically. And I'm sure it probably would, given a long enough period of time, but there clearly were, I think, some obstacles. Greenspan called them headwinds. I think that what happened is that a whole generation of bankers got burned, and I think that they were very cautious coming out of it, and I think that the credit side, the credit channel, I think it was an inhibitor of the monetary channel during those periods. I think the regulatory side, bank examination side, contributed to that, and I think we came to the conclusion in the Fed that there were these obstacles, these headwinds, the term was used, that interest rates would have to be taken considerably lower than we thought. And we actually took, by that time, inflation was down to around 3%, and basically took funds rate down to 3%, which was essentially a zero real rate, and we all knew at the time that was unsustainably low, that we would have to bring them back up and probably do it, hopefully, in a preemptive way. But I think people wanted to get the economy moving, and I think the only real instrument, there were big deficits, and there had been some tax increases to try to do something about the deficit. I think monetary policy was the only show in town, really, and so I think we were all prepared to do it. But I remember, as we did it, said to ourselves, said to each other, that we're going to do this, but this is temporary, and we're going to have enough courage to get those rates back up, or we're going to be right back in the inflationary problem. And sort of opportunistic approach would go by the wayside, that we wouldn't hold inflation in check. We would lose the gains that we had given them.
Starting in early 94, going through early 95, the Fed raised the funds rate, my recollection is, from 6%.
There was some talk about doing it in 93. There was some talk in the
Greenspan feel like he needs to forewarn the markets before he raises interest rates? Is he concerned that, you know, people are just getting in a jam if rates go up too quickly?
I don't think that that's, that may be one of the reasons, but I think that he thought that the Fed should be communicating to the market, and I think the top popular term now is transparency. I think that he just felt that the market shouldn't be surprised, and if you minimize surprises, that you would minimize unpleasant side effects, and that I think he also wanted to teach the market how the Fed was thinking, and so that when the Fed indeed made a market move, that it would be largely anticipated, and the shock value would not be there. And I think that that view really caught on, that the Fed should be as transparent as possible. And in those days, I think that was part of that process.
In 94, when rates went up so sharply, did Greenspan have any problem bringing along Alan Blinder and, you know, who was a Clinton appointee or others? Or
I don't, you know, as I recall, there were people, I think wasn't Martha still on the board at that point? Or had she gone on? I think she, there were some dissents, but I think there were people like Martha Seeger.
Didn't Governor Loewer replace her? I'd have to go back and look.
I don't remember.
My recollection. Loewer replaced her. That's my recollection.
I think might have dissented in there at some point. But Blinder, I think, understood the logic of it. And I think, as I recall, Greenspan really did a pretty good job of bringing people along. There were dissents, but I... If Martha was still on the board, she certainly would have been one. Loewer, if I recall, dissented along the way. But, you know, and Wayne occasionally dissented, but he was coming off the board about then, too, wasn't he?
Yes.
So, you know, you'd have to go back and look at the dissents.
Sure,
but
sure.
I think he did a pretty good job bringing people along, and I think we all knew that having essentially a zero funds rate was unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
That was just kind of the understanding that those of us that had were forward it and have to bring it back up. We just didn't know exactly when.
Yeah. The next big crises were for Mexico and then Asia and Russia. Do you feel like the Fed's going to look pretty good with hindsight in those? Do you feel like that we did create some problems, moral hazard perhaps, with Mexico and then Asia coming, you know, raising
the Asian thing is more firmly in my mind. I think as time goes on, I think people will, the Asian crisis will fade in people's memories, and I think people will look back and say the Fed should have tightened earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was two things that caused the Fed to delay. One was the Asian crisis, and the other was the century date change. And I think that, you know, in hindsight, things like that never looked to be as potentially dangerous as they do when you're looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
Monday morning quarterbacking is easier than making decisions during the game on Saturday afternoon, and I think people were genuinely concerned that the Asian crisis, and it spread like wildfire, and I think people were quite concerned that the system was at risk. And then we had the century date change, which turned out to be not much, but loomed very large in people's minds. And I think that there's no doubt that we stayed easy too long. And I think without those two events, crisis. And that got us, got sidetracked by that into 99, and I think we probably would have been fine to have tightened then, and then people were saying, oh my gosh, we've got this central date change. That was a problem.
And what was the concern about the century date change in terms of interest rates? It was just, you know, a combination of stresses. If you had big computer failures,
well,
at the
I
same
think
time
it was just the idea to be sure that there was plenty of liquidity in the system and that there wouldn't be a seizing up. You know, you recall that we had all these cash storage places around the country.
Oh yeah.
And,
oh yeah, it was a huge big deal.
It was a big deal, and I think that there was just this sense that that there could be a computer failure and that it would get people weren't paying their weren't paying off, and could just get a liquidity crisis, and that
do you think that the Federal Reserve System has created an impossible job in the form of the chairmanship of the Federal Open Market Committee? Do you think we can find mere human beings who can follow Volcker and Greenspan?
The answer to that is yes.
Just covered 30 years. You have a pretty good memory. Anything that we should get on the record in terms of your overall feelings about
it? I have to say that, and probably here, I know Al would differ with this view, but I think that there are some people who would like to clear sense of what it is you're trying to accomplish, but I think the world gets too complicated to think that you can make monetary policy with rules. I think the experience with the European Central Bank, I think they've come to the conclusion that they need a little more latitude. Now, I'll admit it's a trade-off. I mean, if you have it loose enough, then you could easily find yourself back where we were in the 1970s. But I think if you have it, if the rules too tight, I think you don't take into account the complexities of the real world.
No.
So I think you need this kind of discipline, discretion, and I'll admit that that's a more difficult thing to explain. I don't think it's very popular in academia, and I know that Al and I, as good friends as we are, and as much as we respect each other, would probably respectfully differ on that. But I would love to be able to think of a rule that would get us through things, but frankly, I don't think it's fair, and I think we're always going to have a significant element of discretion to get us through life.
Okay. Well, gee.
Greenspan go out. Boom, and we're going to have Al go out. We're going to have Bob Perry.
Yeah, I think that was one reason they appointed Don Cohn, but you can't put it all off on one person.
A lot of institutional memory, and we're going to have I was the first of that sort of generation to go. I was the first to get the job around the table, but I was one of the first to go. And I think we saw that happen early in my tenure, where we had an awful lot of people of the just go by the wayside. Now, Bob Black fortunately, his 20 years, or roughly 20 years, was very helpful in maintaining that institutional memory, because he was both a colleague, for example, of the Dave Eastburn generation.
That's right.
And of my generation. And I always found Bob be very helpful. Now, I guess we have Gary Stern in there and people like that who will be around. But yeah, I think Don Cohn certainly can play that role. You're right. We don't. A lot of it is just passed on. And I know, frankly, I don't think about this stuff very much. I get into a conversation like this, and then even though I'm out of the Fed and don't really have any constraints, I still respect the institution so much that I probably wouldn't be quite as open with outsiders as I would be with you. And yet, we don't have anything to hide, really. I mean, we ought to be open about it, talk about it, and talk about the human side of it as well as policy side of it. So I'm glad that glad you're doing it. I suppose I don't know how the Bob Woodward book was read pretty widely,
but yet that sort of book, it's just sort of this happened and that happened,
and it was sort of a glorification.
There's no logic to you don't have any understanding of why things happened.
It was kind of a news report.
Exactly,
I think you need somebody who can write in plain English, but at the same time has the intellectual capacity to make it all hang together.
Well, that combination of abilities has always been very important at the Philadelphia Fed, and I know you had something to do with creating that kind of research department, so that's
a good luck. And if you want to give me a call back somewhere along the line, I'll be happy to be helpful, because I am